You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Disease Du Jour podcast. I'm your host, Carly Sisson, and in this episode, I talked with Dr. Isabel Kilcoyne about regional limb perfusions. This episode of Disease Du Jour is brought to you by Equithrive. Dr. Kilcoyne graduated from the University College Dublin in 2008, where she spent a year as an equine surgical intern at the University Veterinary Hospital. Following this, she joined the equine field service team at UC Davis for 2 years, after which she completed an equine surgery residency at the UC Davis Veterinary Medical Teaching Hospital. She obtained board certification from the American College of Veterinary Surgeons in 2015, and is currently working as an associate professor in equine emergency and critical care at UC Davis. Her main clinical and research interests involve advances in the diagnostics and management of colic and treatment of orthopedic infections and wounds. Thank you, Dr. Kilcoyne, for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
Can you start out by giving us a quick overview of what regional limb perfusion is and how it works?
Yeah, so basically what the procedure entails is you're isolating the limb from the systemic circulation by placing a tourniquet. And so basically what we're trying to do is get a really high concentration of antibiotics to that portion of the limb. And so we leave the tourniquet on for about, 20, 30 minutes, something like that, and allow the antibiotics to diffuse into the soft tissues and the bone and the synovial structures of the limb, and basically get like higher concentrations than we would be able to achieve with systemic administration.
So what are some of the common clinical scenarios where you would recommend performing this procedure?
Yeah, so typically we use it for orthopedic infections of the distal limb. So I work on our emergency surgery service, so we see a lot of like wounds. Because horses have very limited soft tissue coverage on the distal limb, and any kind of laceration or wound, we tend to see involvement of like, bone, either joints, bursas, and tendon sheets, and even tendons and ligaments as well. So any of those kind of cases where we've got an orthopedic infection as a result of a wound. Also, like sometimes we'll use them for horses that are undergoing orthopedic fracture repair as well. So particularly if they have an open fracture, they have a much higher rate of ending up with an infection afterwards. But even with, more elective fracture repairs or kind of, arthrodeses, we'll sometimes prophylactically do regional limb perfusions on those horses as well to increase concentrations of antibiotics prior to the procedure and to hopefully prevent any infections afterwards. We see a lot of street nails here in California, and that would be another kind of clinical scenario where we would use regional limbs perfusions quite frequently as well. So basically any infection or kind of septic process that's going on in the distal limb.
Right. A lot of applications, it sounds like. What are some antibiotics that you use commonly in this procedure, and how do you decide which antibiotics to use?
Yeah, good question. So we typically use amikacin. So amikacin is an aminoglycoside antibiotic. It's the most kind of studied one when pertaining to like regional limb perfusions. But there's a few different reasons that we use it. So the first reason is it's concentration dependent antibiotics. So we tend to not have to give those antibiotics as frequently as one like a penicillin that might be more of a time dependent antibiotic. So we tend to see levels kind of high for a more prolonged period with those antibiotics. The other big advantage of amikacin for us is when we're thinking about like the reasons we would be doing the procedure. So if they have a wound or a laceration, the most common bacteria that we see associated with wounds would be staphylococcal species. So obviously staph lives on the skin, so it's going to likely contaminate any wounds. And then because of the contaminated environment the horse lives in, enterics, so like E. coli and things like that. And the nice thing about amikacin is that we have very good spectrum of coverage for gram-negative aerobes, but also staphylococcus as well. And so like Staph aureus that might be living on the skin. So same thing if we've got, an infection from an orthopedic implant, or if we've got an infection because of an iatrogenic infection in a joint, potentially after joint medication, we do those really, really frequently. And it's a really low rate of infection, but if we do get an infection, it's most likely going to be a staph because it gets dragged in on the needle, or, you know, after an elective surgery, it gets contaminated from the skin. So that's why amikacin would be the most commonly used one. So we're getting kind of big bang for our buck with covering what bacterial species we're worried about or would be the more common pathogens. And there's definitely reports, and, you know, depending then as a case progresses and depending on the results of like what culture and sensitivities you have, you know, if it's an infected synovial structure or a bad wound or a chronic wound, things like that, we may alter what antibiotic we're using depending on the culture and sensitivity results, but it usually takes a few days for those to come back. So other ones that we would use typically depending on culture and sensitivity would be a third generation cephalosporin sometimes. And there's reports out there of using various other antibiotics, but definitely amikacin would be the most frequently used one and the most studied one, I suppose.
Okay, great. Has your antibiotic selection process changed at all in light of growing concerns about resistance, or is that sort of a non-factor so far?
No, it's definitely a factor. And like, it's one of the things that we are trying to be way more cognizant of. And that's one of the things with regional lymph perfusions, is that we hope we're getting high enough concentrations that we're going to kill that bacteria and get above our MIC at the minimum inhibitory concentration. So I think, you know, with that procedure, we're less likely to see hopefully developing resistance because we're getting high enough levels if the procedure's performed correctly. But definitely that's one of the big reasons why we're submitting more cultures and sensitivities, is that you don't want to be using an antibiotic that's not necessarily working. So while it's, you know, maybe covers the more common things, it's still really important to do your cultures and sensitivities and make sure that you are using the right antibiotic for sure.
Right. Yeah, definitely important.
This episode of Disease du Jour is sponsored by Equithrive. Brought to you by Equithrive, the leaders in resveratrol science, Medicare is a new pelleted daily supplement offering metabolic support for easy keepers. Medicare was formulated by Pat Lawless, PhD, to support optimum carbohydrate and fat metabolism, healthy body weight, and appropriate insulin levels in horses, thanks to a proprietary combination of resveratrol, flavonoids, and amino acids. Learn more at www.equithrive.com.
Do you have a preferred technique for performing RLPs?
Yeah, and everybody kind of does it like a little bit differently, I suppose. There's kind of like, you know, the standard steps of, you know, putting on your tourniquet, having everything kind of prepped prior to putting on your tourniquet and making sure, you know, the horse is well sedated and all that. I guess for me, the big points are like, I try to get the horse very well sedated right before I'm ready to start the procedure. So I give them like, you know, 3 or 4 minutes after giving the sedation, but I try to kind of time my sedation with when I'm ready to go. So I'm ready to, you know, do the procedure so that I'm not kind of on the tail end of the sedation. And hopefully that helps prevent them moving too much if they're well sedated for the whole, you know, 20 minutes that I leave the tourniquet on. The other bigger kind of more important thing, I think, based off of like, you know, different studies that we've done, and is the tourniquet placement is really, really important. So for me, that's like one of the biggest things that I try to be very consistent with and try to do a really good job. So particularly like in the front limb, if you're using your cephalic vein, it tends to kind of live in that little groove. And so you always want to be careful that your tourniquet is actually occluding it. So typically I'll use like some gauze or kind of a cling underneath the tourniquet to make sure that I'm getting sufficient pressure to occlude that vessel. And then I'm very careful to put the tourniquet on as tight as I can possibly get it as well. And so the whole point is to try and kind of maximize the efficacy of the procedure, so I'm not getting any systemic leakage into the circulation when I'm given my perfusate. So once I'm happy with how the tourniquet's placed and horse is already sedated, I try to do when I'm placing my catheter. So there's two different ways that people do it. So some people will just do a butterfly catheter, which is fine. Other people will use, and I like to use the over the needle catheters, and usually like a 23 gauge or a 21 gauge. And I like the catheters a little bit better because in a hospital setting, I tend to be doing the procedure more frequently, like every day for a few days. So kind of preserves the vein a little bit, and I feel like once the catheter is in, they stay in a little bit better than the butterflies that tend to be a bit more flimsy. So when I'm putting my needle or my butterfly catheter in, I try to go, you know, a pretty good distance from where the bottom of my tourniquet is. And the reason for that is I don't want to put my perfusate, so it's usually about 60 mils total volume. I don't want to put that in too close to the bottom of my tourniquet. And for the reason that I'm going to kind of increase the hydrostatic pressure in that area and maybe cause more systemic leakage. So I like to kind of put the catheter in, you know, maybe a good 10 centimeters below where the tourniquet ends to try and kind of reduce the amount of pressure I'm putting on that tourniquet. So then once I get the catheter in and I hook it up, I usually do about 60 mils. So I dilute, you know, in an average sized horse, I usually have 2 grams of amikacin and I dilute it in some lidocaine. And I'm saline to about a total volume of 60 mils. And then when I'm giving that, I give it really slowly. So there was a really nice resident here, Dr. Saldinger, who's finishing up, but she did this really nice study where we were looking at different perfusate times. So how quickly we give the perfusate. So we gave a bunch of horses the perfusate, did the procedure, and when we were injecting it, we did it at one minute, and then we did 5 minutes, and the 5 minutes seems really, really long. And there wasn't a difference in the levels that we got in the joint and when we were measuring the levels of amikacin after the procedure. But what we did find was when we were looking at the systemic circulation, so we were taking samples from the vein at the same time, and there was much higher concentrations in the systemic circulation with the 1 minute perfusate time, meaning that like there was more leakage under the tourniquet. There probably wasn't a difference in the joint levels just because we didn't have enough horses, but we were definitely seeing a significant difference in the systemic leakage when we were given the perfusate very quickly over a minute. So with that, we try to give it very slowly, so at least 3, 4, 5 minutes. So the slower you can give it, the better. And that's for the same reason as like putting the catheter in a little bit lower down. It's just to not increase the hydrostatic pressure right there below your tourniquet and, you know, kind of reduce the efficacy of it. So what else? So then we've given the perfusate, and then we typically leave the tourniquet on for about 20 minutes. And then looking at all the different studies that are out there that kind of look at the time that we reach our peak concentrations, usually by about 20 minutes, you're pretty good. You get concentrations that are sufficient to be good for most bacteria that are targeted by the amikacin. So yeah, that's kind of some of the kind of tweaks that I've done, or that like I personally try to pay a bit more attention to. Tourniquet is a big one, and then how quickly you're actually giving the perfusate.
Right, yeah, that's really useful. Is that typically pretty well tolerated by the horses, even when they're sedated, if they have to, for that whole 20 minute period?
Yeah, good question. I think it varies from horse to horse for sure. And so some horses obviously stand a little bit better. And I think it depends on the environment that they're in and all of that. But I think kind of if you time your sedation pretty well to where they're kind of getting your peak sedation right when you're putting the tourniquet on, I feel like the 20 minutes, they last pretty well. That's another thing that, like, you know, every horse is different and every vet has a different like sedation protocol that they like. And I used to err more on doing like detomidine and butorphanol all together. And then for a lot of our studies, there was one that we did looking at morphine, but I couldn't use butorphanol when we were giving morphine because of the antagonist effect. And so we just did detomidine in those horses, and actually I found they stood a little bit better. I think partly because with the torb, sometimes they try to lean forward a little bit more, they kind of head press a little bit more sometimes. So now I'll try her on kind of just doing more detomidine on its own, and then trying to give them, you know, a good dose to start off with, so I don't have to top them up. That being said, if they start moving a little bit, or I think they're kind of unweighting the leg or seeming uncomfortable with the tourniquet, then I'll just give them a bit of a top up and just try and get them through the 20 minutes. But if we keep the environment pretty quiet and they kind of settle into the sedation, I feel like most of them stand pretty well. And then the other thing we do for that is we put the lidocaine actually in with the perfusate. So I usually put about 20 mils of lidocaine, and it's kind of like a bear block, kind of like what they do in cows sometimes when they're doing surgery. And I feel like it helps. And so clinically speaking, I feel like that helps. And I feel like that the horses stand a little bit better when they have the lidocaine included in it. In most of the studies that you read that are kind of like on healthy horses, a lot of the time we'll do nerve blocks, and like a median and ulnar nerve block when we're doing the procedure to try and reduce discomfort associated with the tourniquet and the procedure. But in the clinical scenario, it just takes like a little bit extra time. And I feel like it's a bit inconsistent how well the block works as well. So I don't tend to use that in a clinical setting, but I will put lidocaine in with the perfusate itself and hoping that that kind of helps it be a little bit more comfortable for them.
Okay, yeah, great advice. How many treatments do you typically have to perform, or is this highly variable based on the case?
Kind of same thing. It's a bit variable based on the case and kind of based on, like, you know, what your situation is too. You know, for us, we're lucky they're in the hospital, so it's easy for us to pull them up and get it done. But if you're in the field, having to go back every day and do one, you know, might not be practical either. And usually what we'll do with, like, a horse, you know, that has a wound over a joint, if we take it to surgery, and you know, obviously the day it goes to surgery, it gets amikacin in the actual joint itself, so we don't need to do it then. And then we'll maybe do a regional limb perfusion for, like, the following 2 days or 3 days. And then usually on the third or fourth day, we'll tap the joint because we'll want to see if our cytological values are improved from the pre-surgical or the initial tap. And then we can inject amikacin directly then as well. The big caveat with regional limb perfusions, and if you look at any of the studies that are done, the levels that we get are, like, super variable. And even within, like, the same horse getting the procedure multiple times, it can be really variable, the levels of amikacin that you get. And that's the big caveat with the procedure. So, and obviously in a clinical setting, we're not measuring what levels we're getting, so we don't really know. And when you inject the joint directly, you know you're getting a really high concentration in the joint. But that's the thing with regional limb perfusions, is that it's very, very variable. So it's not something that I rely on 100%. You know, I kind of have that in the back of my mind. And so if I'm going to tap joint, I'd rather inject the amikacin at that time than do a regional limb perfusion, because I know for sure that I'm getting high levels when I directly inject the joint. So it's definitely got its place, but with that in mind, kind of knowing that it might be a little bit variable sometimes. But usually we'll do kind of, like, I think kind of a good standard protocol. There's no, like, definitive protocol out there, but I think usually, you know, with a street nail horse, or, you know, bad wound that maybe isn't necessarily into a joint, and we'll do, like, maybe three. And then at that stage, you're kind of looking to see clinically how the horse is doing. Are they walking well? Does the wound look better? Those kind of things. And so usually three. We would rarely, you know, there'd be very complicated cases if we were doing more than four or five, or kind of ongoing. And at that stage too, you know, if the horse isn't improving, is it because, you know, your amikacin isn't working? Do you need to have a culture? See if it's a different bacteria involved. Is there something else going on? Does the horse need another surgery? That kind of thing. So right. I think three is a pretty, like, standard number. And then usually, like, at the, trying to do them at the same time every day, but on a daily basis typically. But even, you know, if you're out in the field and you have a street nail and you pull a nail and, you know, it's not in anything really bad, but you want to get high concentrations to kind of get you over the hump, just doing one is fine. Like, one is better than none. So it just kind of depends on the situation. And there's definitely no definitive guidelines there. It's usually just based on kind of clinician preference and then how the horse is doing.
Right. So it sounds like there's no real concrete way of monitoring success. It's more about, like, monitoring the clinical signs of the horse. And
exactly.
Do you have any other tips there?
Yeah, usually just monitoring how the horse is doing. You know, when they have an infected joint, that's something that's kind of easy to monitor, relatively easy. But you kind of have your cytology values from when they come in, ideally, as your baseline. And then you can kind of be measuring, you know, tapping that joint and getting a sample a few days after surgery or a few days after treatment, even if the horse didn't have surgery, and seeing if it's responding. You know, with more chronic infections, maybe you've got, like, abnormalities on your CBC or your SAA, and kind of looking at those kind of systemic clinical variables. But typically it's more how the horse is doing clinically. Are they looking better? Are they walking better? And then kind of using that. It's hard too, because, you know, whenever we're doing regional limb perfusions, it's not like we're doing them on their own either. There's a ton of other variables to consider. So, like, they're obviously getting wound care, they're getting systemic antibiotics as well. There's all these other things going on and kind of part of the picture too. So I think they kind of add, or, like, an adjunctive treatment to everything else that we're doing, are the more kind of standard protocols. But definitely, I think, you know, over the last 10 years when we've been doing more of them, I feel like we're seeing improved clinical outcomes because we're doing more of them.
Right. Yeah, that's great. Are there any potential complications associated with the procedure that veterinarians should watch out for?
Yes, definitely. So usually it's a pretty benign procedure. And so, you know, equine vets are pretty good at getting catheters in, and the cephalic and the saphenous in the hind tend to be, you know, they're pretty easy to see and hopefully easy enough to hit with a butterfly catheter or an over the needle catheter. But, you know, things we worry about, hematoma formation, it can happen sometimes if the catheter moves a little bit or it takes one or two sticks, they can get a pretty big hematoma. And if that happens, sometimes it's really hard to get the regional done at that stage. And so sometimes you just have to kind of put pressure and like get a little bandage on there, and typically they do fine. And if you're doing repeated sticks and so they're getting, you know, a few regionals over a period of a number of days, and then, you know, we have seen some horses get like phlebitis associated with the actual catheter insertion site. And we've had one or two that have gotten, you know, some kind of thrombus formation or just associated with repeated sticks as well. Usually if you're just doing one or two, we tend to not see so much of a problem. And this would be like, considering the number of regionals that we do, you know, it's very uncommon, but things to kind of think about. I've had a few in different studies that we've done, I had one or two get like regional cellulitis, and they were usually ones that we were doing in the winter where there was kind of, you know, some, the horses were a bit more muddy. And so I think, you know, getting the leg, obviously the area where you're putting the catheter in, you're cleaning really well. And doesn't necessarily have to be a full sterile prep, but getting it as clean as you can get it. And then, you know, obviously not having like dirt from the horses falling down when they move or when they shake or whatever. So pretty low rate of complications, and most of them tend to be mild. But things to watch out for would be really just swelling associated with the catheter site, and then hopefully not getting any kind of phlebitis or thrombosis there of the vessel. But would be, you know, uncommon. Like I've maybe seen one or two really bad thromboses associated with the procedure, and you know, I've seen hundreds or thousands of it. So
right. So overall, very safe procedure for the most part.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So I would love to talk a little bit about some of the recent research that you've been involved with on adding morphine to the perfusate while performing regional imperfusions. Can you briefly explain sort of the motivation behind this research and some of the key findings and how that might shape treatments moving forward?
Yeah, so we did this study just to see, you know, if we gave morphine through the regional imperfusion, one, if we were getting levels in the joint. And then to make sure that if we give it with the amikacin, we weren't kind of seeing an effect, like the main reason with the septic joint or kind of an infectious process was that you want the antibiotics to get there. But if we could give them some analgesic at the same time, that would be great. A lot of the horses that come in with like, you know, really bad street nail or an infected synovial structure, they can be really painful. And so a lot of the time we're managing or trying to manage their pain in the hospital. So our kind of go-tos are obviously going to be your NSAIDs, bute, sometimes banamine, and then systemic opioids. So a lot of the time we're giving them, you know, morphine a few times a day or hydromorphone, and that's easy to do in the hospital obviously as well. But you know, we worry about the systemic side effects of that as well. So obviously with NSAIDs we worry about our kidneys, and then GI issues with given repeated doses of systemic opioids. We've had some good success, I think, clinically of, you know, doing epidural catheters on some of the horses with hind leg issues as well. And so the epidural morphine seems to last longer than if it's given systemically. And so the thought was, well, you know, if we're doing a regional imperfusion to give antibiotics anyway, maybe if we give the morphine in it, one, we'll get the clinical effect of the morphine, but hopefully it would last longer and reduce the amount we have to give systemically. So, yeah, we did it on a few BIMI-6 healthy horses, and we found we got pretty good levels in the synovial structures. And when we measured it, and we didn't seem to have an effect on the amikacin that was given either. It was kind of similar to previous levels we'd gotten in other studies. And the levels that we got in the joint, it was definitely higher than what we would get if we injected the morphine systemically, so giving it IV, but obviously not quite as high as what we would get if you gave the morphine directly into the joint. And so kind of midway between. So definitely something that you can do, and if the horse is pretty painful. And the big thing with that is, depending on your sedation protocols, remembering not to give any TORB with it because you can antagonize. So yeah, we've done it on a few cases in the clinic now, and you know, if they're really painful, we'll give them morphine with it, and I feel like it helps, and it does seem to kind of tide them over a little bit longer than if we're giving repeated doses of the systemic morphine. So I feel like it's just one more tool in your toolbox. There's been a few other papers out there recently too, looking at, like, there was one that looked at giving bute through regional limb perfusion. They didn't get super good levels. And I think that study too, you know, we worry about perivascular leakage of the bute too. It can cause a pretty nasty reaction or inflammatory reaction. But I think kind of, you know, we're looking more of like analgesic processes to kind of like help horses that are having these painful conditions. And like, I think the morphine is kind of a really interesting one, and potentially hydromorphone as well. And if it works and you're doing the regional to give antibiotics anyways, I don't see why you wouldn't just give some morphine with it. So yeah, I liked that study. It was a cool study, and I think, you know, could help some horses hopefully.
Yeah, it sounds like a really exciting possibility moving forward. Is there any other ongoing research that you'd like to highlight today before we wrap up that could help shape treatments in the future?
No, I think my whole thing is trying to, like, I feel like it's one of these things, you know, people say the more you know, the less you know.
Right.
And that's one of the things I find like really frustrating with regional limb perfusions. It's like I've done a lot of different studies on healthy horses, and I feel like, you know, I think for me, the thing that I've learned over the last few years is just how variable the levels I'm getting are. Like, I'm very consistent and very particular about how tourniquets get put on, and there'll be a horse that we'll do a regional limb perfusion on in a study, and the horse will stand perfectly, everything goes first stick, everything looks perfect. I would say that horse should have really, really high levels, and then the horse has really low levels when we measure the joint. So, and then we'll have another horse that's moving the whole time, doesn't stand well, and then it just feels like everything's going wrong, and they'll have super high levels. So I think for me, realizing that it's so variable and not being totally reliant on using a regional limb perfusions, you know, if you are going to tap a joint or get a sample, then that's always going to be kind of a better method to get antibiotic in there. But, you know, treating kind of a bigger, larger area with the amikacin and doing the regional limb perfusion is always good too. So I think just being super aware of the limitations of the procedure is important. And definitely the other big things would be, you know, being really careful with how the tourniquet is put on. That's like, I think, the number one factor. And then giving it very, very slowly when you're injecting the perfusate, when you're doing the procedure. They were kind of big take-home points with me with different studies that we've done. But I think stuff that, like, in the future, I think trying to kind of see, maximize the efficacy and kind of reduce human error when we're doing it. So that's kind of what we've been trying to do. I feel like, you know, everybody, what do they say, 10 ways to skin a cat or whatever, like everybody has different ways of doing things, which is great. And so that's why I love talking to people about like how they like to do them, because I'm like, oh, okay, that's really kind of a bit different. Like, I'd like to see if that actually makes a difference in like the levels that we're getting. And so for me, talking to people about how clinically they do things is really helpful, because then, you know, we can study that and then we can see if we're getting higher levels with it. So I think trying to kind of standardize it a little bit better so that we know what's the most efficacious way to do it. And then, like, there's other stuff, you know, like the analgesics, administering the analgesics, I think is kind of very cool, and potentially different ways to kind of like help the horse. There was a study that we did actually looking at DMSO, and it was a vet that had come up to me at a meeting, and we were just chit-chatting about regional limb perfusions, and he was saying that he uses DMSO a lot. And I was like, yeah, you know, like, that kind of could be really interesting. And we did it, so where we used like a 10% DMSO solution with the amikacin, and it wasn't statistically significant in the study, but again, we didn't have that many horses. That's a big problem with equine research as well, is that, like, you potentially could see a difference if you just used more horses. But this was one of the studies where it was very close to significant, like the closest that I've seen a difference in a lot of our studies. And where with the DMSO, we were getting higher levels of amikacin in the joints. And so that's, again, something else that I think would be kind of cool, like as a carrier drug, so to speak, where it's kind of helping increase your synovial concentrations of amikacin. So yeah, I think kind of like looking at different things to try and like standardize, but also like different things that other people use as well that they feel like works well for them in practice. Like, I love talking to people about it and kind of seeing different ways of doing things, and then actually looking and seeing, does that have an effect?
Yeah, hopefully that DMSO topic is a great avenue for future research, because that sounds pretty interesting too. Yeah. But I know it's so hard to get enough horses involved, and it's expensive and it's time consuming. And
yeah, and you kind of feel bad too, like the procedure isn't like a, you know, super hard on them or anything, but you kind of don't want to be using more horses than you need to use either. So yeah, we try to be really careful with that too.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, thank you so much for coming on today and sharing all of your insight with us. I want to say thank you again to Dr. Kilcoyne for joining us, and thank you to Equithrive for supporting this episode. And as always, thank you to our audience for listening to Disease Du Jour. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, please send me an email at csisson@equinenetwork.com.